This is actually the last real lecture because next week it's loose ends. So I've been keeping track of things that I promised to do and things that I did badly. And I'm going to basically walk through the whole argument next week from where to go and tell you how I did all the things that I said I was going to do. Okay. And then I'm going to do some infill where I did things badly. I'm going to try and do it again. Okay. But this lecture is a natural, as you know, a natural flow-on from what we were talking about last time. Last time we were talking about what moral reasons were and what non-moral reasons were. And as I said at the end of the last lecture, we learned something by talking about what our moral reasons and our non-moral reasons are. And that is that there's a very uneasy relationship between our nature as humans, our human nature, and our nature as agents, for which a certain kind of agent is the ideal. There's a very uneasy tension between those two things. And the reason there's an uneasy tension is because much of what we makes our lives worthwhile and we're trying to do, many of the reasons we have are grounded in our human nature, and yet many of the obstacles to our doing what we have reason to do are also grounded in our human nature. So our human nature is both our best friend and our worst enemy. Okay. Just by the way, I forgot to mention this last time, but I'm going to mention it now. Last time was Russell, was some anniversary of Russell's. And last Wednesday. And this view that I was pushing, that nature is our friend and our enemy, this was actually the theme of Russell's, or it was part of that, was the theme of his Nobel Prize speech. What he claimed was that we have a common enemy, and that's nature. And that's a thesis that I think I believe. Okay, so there's a natural question to ask if that's true. Namely, what do we do when we're confronted by our own failures? And the answer is we go in for practices of blame. So here's what I'm going to try and do today. I'm going to try and tell you what the psychological state of blaming someone is. And that account of the nature of the psychological state of blaming someone has to be capable of doing two things. First of all, it's got to explain why it's sometimes permissible and maybe even obligatory on occasion to blame people. That might sound like a trivial requirement, but as you'll see, certain theories of blame fail to meet it. Secondly, it's got to explain why blaming people has the blameworthiness of those blamed among its correctness conditions. That is, why it's appropriate to blame when the object of blame is blameworthy. Now, as I said, this is and as the title of the talk makes clear, this is in part a normative task. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to draw freely on the normative conclusions that we argued for in previous lectures. So remember, what I've suggested is that we all have two moral reasons. These reasons are what I'm calling dominant, that is to say they have substantial strength. And they can be weighed against each other. One of these reasons is a reason not to interfere with anyone's exercise of their capacity to know the world, what the world is like, or to realise their desires in that world, on condition, of course, that the desires they have aren't desires that would lead them to interfere with anybody else. That, of course, is crucial for the topic of today's lecture. And the second is a reason to do what we can to make sure that everyone has the capacity to acquire knowledge and realise their desires. Again, on condition that the satisfaction of those desires that they're going to have won't require them to interfere. So in a phrase, we all have these moral reasons to help and not interfere. These reasons can conflict with each other, and so they have to be thought of as having relative weights. The view that I proposed last time was that we should think of them as having roughly the same weight. And that, in conjunction with the thesis that these terms are vague, means that much moral inquiry is a quandary. quandary into how to proceed given the vagueness of what the injunction is that we should do. And what I suggested last time was that we solve that problem by coordinating with each other in order to develop conventions that give the concepts of interfering and helping much more precise content. So part of what we have reason to do, it turns out, isn't just to help and not interfere, but to maintain conventions and improve conventions that give those ideas more determinate content. The other thing that we have, though, in addition to these reasons to help and not interfere, these moral reasons, we have non-moral reasons to do whatever we want to do. And these non-moral reasons can be weighed against the moral reasons. Now, that might sound surprising when I first say that, because, of course, the way the argument for the moral reasons got going was by thinking of them as dominating the non-moral reasons. But the reason it turns out that they have to be weighted, that the non-moral reasons have to be weighed against the moral reasons, is precisely because of this point about the indeterminacy in their content and the conventional nature of the precisification of their content. What that means is there are going to be borderline cases where it'll be appropriate to describe you as interfering, but the interference will be so minor and maybe outside the scope of the kind of conventional precisification that what you'll be have reason to do is to satisfy some non-moral reason, act on some non-moral reason that you've got, grounded in some desire you have, notwithstanding the fact that you'd be interfering. So I gave various examples to support this last time. I'm not going to repeat all of that here. But anyway, so that's the story. There are these two reasons, just to repeat again, there are these two moral reasons, reasons to help and not interfere, and then there are these reasons, the non-moral reasons, to do whatever we want to do. And much of the time last time was I talked about three different kinds of non-moral reason that we have. Reasons grounded in pleasure, reasons grounded in self-interest, and reasons grounded in love and friendship. Okay? All of those are distinctively human reasons because they're grounded in facts about our human nature. Okay, now given that account of what reasons we have, we can define what it is for acts to be morally forbidden, permitted and obligatory and superfluous. An act is morally permitted just in case we have these reasons to help and not interfere, and they don't outweigh any of the reasons that we have to act otherwise and to do the thing that we have moral permission to do. So, for example, the reasons to help and not interfere might count in favour of our doing the thing that we're morally permitted to do, and not be outweighed by any reasons, whether moral or non-moral, to act otherwise. Or they might count against acting in that way, but not decisively against doing so, as in the case I just mentioned, where you had some non-moral reason to act in a certain way, and that reason turns out to be weightier in the circumstance. Or they might just be silent on so acting. So once you get the concept of moral permission defined, you just then do the standard definitions of what it is for acts to be obligatory and forbidden. An act is obligatory if it's uniquely permitted, and to say it's forbidden is just to say it's not permitted. Okay? So they're our definitions. And what I've got to be able to do then is to argue that it's sometimes morally permissible to blame. And what that means is our blaming people must... It's going to be morally permissible to blame people when either our blaming them is supported by our reasons to help and not interfere, and these reasons aren't outweighed by our reasons not to blame them, or when our reasons to help and not interfere are silent on our blaming them, or when our reasons to help and not interfere count against blaming them, but not decisively against our doing so. Okay. So what I have to be able to show you is that sometimes these conditions are met. Okay, that's the task. Now, with this account of moral permissibility assumed in what follows, let's now turn to what it is to blame someone. Now, actually, I won't read from this slide. I'll just tell you what I'm going to do, and you don't have to read it either. There are some common sense answers to the questions under what condition, what is blame and when is it appropriate to blame. And I think of myself in this talk as just defending the common sense view. That's what I think. I think the view that I've given of what it is to be morally permissible is going to generate out a completely commonsensical story of what it is to blame. Okay, so that's my task. However, unfortunately, the completely commonsensical view of what it is to blame people basically got sidelined in the 1970s when Gary Watson published this fantastic paper called Skepticism About Weakness of Will. Because what Watson did in that paper was to argue that very, very persuasively describe what the common sense conditions were and then argue that they couldn't be met. So what the first thing that we have to do is respond to Watson. Now, once I've responded to Watson, that will present us with a new puzzle, and I'll get to that in just a tick. So here's the common sense claim about the role of belief in action explanation when it's appropriate to blame. So here's the thought. We can distinguish between two people who both have a false belief about what they have reason to do, where one has that false belief as a result of their having but failing to exercise their capacity to have a true belief, and the other has the false belief as a result of entirely lacking the capacity to have the true belief. So think of the second person as someone who's, say, brainwashed, and think of the first person as someone who's just, you know, normal. Now imagine these two people, one who's brainwashed and one who's normal. They both have a false belief about what they have reason to do. The second because of brainwashing, the first just because of though they have the capacity to have the true belief, they fail to exercise it in the circumstance. If they each act on their belief about what they have reason to do, and as a result, say, harm somebody, then, here's the common sense thought, blame would be appropriate in the first case, but not in the second. In other words, lacking the capacity to have a belief which is germane to the action that you perform, lacking the capacity to have the true belief, if you act on some false belief and thereby cause harm, that's going to get you off the hook as regards blame is concerned. Here's the common sense claim about desire and its role in action explanation when it's appropriate to blame. It's just the same thing, again, except just transposed over to the case of desire. So we ordinarily distinguish between two people who both know that they have reason to act in a certain way, but neither of whom desires to act in that way, where one's lack of a desire is a result of their failure to exercise the capacity to acquire the desire, but they have it. They have self-control, but they didn't exercise it. And the second's, the explanation of the second's lack of desire is that they lack the control. They lack the self-control. They can't get themselves to have that desire. Now again, here's the common sense thought. The common sense thought is that if each of these people cause harm as a result of their failure to desire to do what they know they have reason to do, then blame would be appropriate in the first case, but not in the second. That's the common sense claim. Now this, as I said, this common sense idea was basically called into question by Gary Watson in the 70s in this terrific paper, Skepticism About Weakness of Will. So what he does is he focuses on cases of failure to acquire some desire that you have. Cases of weakness of will. And what he argues is that in that case, there's just no distinction between having a capacity but failing to exercise it and lacking a capacity. And that's the nature of the argument again. There's no distinction that you can make between having a capacity and failing to exercise it and lacking the capacity altogether. Now, his argument for that conclusion basically turned on how you explain an agent's failure to exercise a capacity. Right. Now, how do you explain how an agent fails to exercise a capacity? The cases he imagined all from memory, they all involve someone lobbing something across a river, trying to lob something across a river, but failing to get it across. Okay, now they failed to do what they intended to do. And the question is, how would you explain why they failed to exercise their capacity to lob it across the river? So one possibility is that they had a false belief about what they needed to do in order to get it across the river. They didn't try hard enough because they didn't realise so much effort would be required. There what you have is a case where the explanation of their failure is a kind of ignorance. But that's not what's going on in cases of weakness of will. It's not a kind of ignorance. You know full well what you have reason to do, and you fail to do it because you lack the self-control to acquire the desire to do it. The other kind of case he imagined was a case where what you discover is that you can't do the thing that you were trying to do. There, the explanation of your failure to exercise the capacity is that you lack the capacity. But again, that's not what's going on in these cases of weakness of will. Because in those cases, what you're meant to think is that the person has the capacity but fails to exercise it. So Watson's conclusion that he draws from this is, look, in these ordinary cases, there are only two kinds of explanation of an agent's failure to exercise a capacity. Neither of them is available in the cases of weakness of will. So it must be that the cases of weakness of will don't exist because there's no case which meets the conditions required for it to be weakness of will. Okay, that's the argument. As I said, this argument was incredibly well received, I think. Well received to the point where people thought that Watson had just demolished the idea of an unexercised capacity. Now, I think that this argument of Watson's is no good. And I think that we could tell that it was no good right from the get-go. And here's the reason. Watson's explanations for why someone fails to exercise a capacity that they have all turn them into cases where it's perfectly rational for them not to fail to exercise the capacity. Either they can't, or else they were just responding perfectly reasonably to the beliefs they had. So his cases all turn the failure cases into cases of rational behaviour. Now, I think we should have our alarm bells should immediately have gone off. Because in cases of weakness of will, the failure to exercise a capacity is meant to be a rational failing. And that tells you something, I think. It tells you that in the special case of failures to exercise a rational capacity, these standard explanations are not going to be the ones that you should even think are in the offing. What is going to be the explanation? Well, I think probably the explanation is going to be just what I said. The explanation is going to be that you had the capacity but failed to exercise it. And then all of the argumentative pressure will be on you to say what that means. So now we can just restate Watson's objection, not now by taking his argument as conclusive proof that there's no such thing as weakness of will, but as a challenge for you to say, okay, think of it this way, I've told you what it could be, and it's not that, so just tell me what it is. What is it for there to be a capacity that you fail to exercise? Okay, now that's the challenge. What is it for it to be true of an agent that they did what they did because they had a capacity but failed to exercise it? So now here's my suggestion, and I've written about this elsewhere, I'm happy to talk about this in the discussion section, so I'm not going to go on at length about this. But here's the idea in a nutshell. The idea in a nutshell is the difference between what we want to explain is the difference between two people who fail to do what they have reason to do. And in one case, they had the capacity but failed to exercise it, and in the other case, they lack the capacity altogether. Now, we'll focus on the special case where they each know what they have reason to do. One of them has the capacity to acquire the desire to do it. The other lacks that capacity. Okay? Focus on that case. What's the difference between those two people? Okay, here's the answer. The answer is, it's a modal difference. Consider the worlds in which the person who has the capacity go to the nearest worlds where they have the desire. Those worlds are going to be closer to the world in which they failed than, now go over to the guy who lacks the capacity. So here's the guy who lacks the capacity to acquire the desire. Go to the nearest worlds where that guy has the desire. Those worlds are going to be more distant from actuality. So what you need in order to spell this story out is an account of what this similarity metric is, in impossible worlds terms, of what it is for one set of worlds, the ones where the guy who has the capacity desires to do the thing he believes he has reason to do, or knows he has reason to do, versus the worlds where the guy who lacks the capacity desires to do what he has reason to do. And the answer to that question, how do you spell out that similarity metric, is basically to write down as conscientiously and thoroughly as possible all of the folk psychological truths about what's required for the exercise of self-control. Because it turns out that the person who has the capacity but fails to exercise it makes many of those claims true, whereas the person who lacks the capacity makes them false. So in other words, all of the truth makers for the claim that the guy has self-control is true of the guy where it's closer, and that's actually what the similarity metric is going to pick up, whereas the guy who fails to exercise self-control because he lacks it, those claims will not be true. Now, as I said, I've actually tried to spell this out in fairly thoroughly in other work, so I'm not going to try and do it here, and I'm not even completely convinced that what I say in that other paper is entirely correct. However, I do think, and this I'm willing to, you know, bet the farm on, I do think that the strategy that I'm suggesting that you employ here, which is to try and find a dimension of similarity along which the person who has the capacity but fails to exercise it does desire it, that is a winning strategy. And the way you do that is by focusing on what it is to have self-control. Okay, now that's my proposal. So the answer is Watson's objection lapses now, and we're back on track. We're back on track. We now know one of the conditions that's required in order to be blameworthy. It's that you had but failed to exercise a capacity either to believe something, presumably what you had reason to do, or desire something, that is presumably to desire the thing that you had reason to do. Now this actually, as I said, brings up another puzzle, and I here want to credit Pam Hieronymy for forcing me to bring this into clear view, and that is, why is it that blame... Okay, just think of what I've said now. I've said that blame has, as one of its correctness conditions, the fact that the person had but failed to exercise some capacity that they have. And secondly, I've then spelled out what it is for them to have but failed to exercise the capacity in these rather arcane modal terms. Right. Now, here's Hieronymy's question. Why does blame have that modal condition on it? What exactly is the relevance of this question about how far off in logical space it is where you have the person who has the capacity but fails to exercise it is doing the right thing? What's the relevance of that? That's going to be crucial. Okay. So here's my initial suggestion. And we'll see what we think about this, and then we'll sort of tease it through. It'll only become clear why this modal condition is so crucial, by the way, in about 30 minutes. So just stick with me, okay? So here's an initial suggestion. What we blame people for is doing the wrong thing when it's their fault. And the modal condition is an explanation of what fault consists in. Fault consists in a failure to exercise a capacity, and that is to be understood in modal terms, right? Um, And here's the kind of natural next thought. So blaming people is really just a matter of believing that they have done the wrong thing when it's their fault. That would be a kind of initial flat-footed suggestion. Now note that that would explain why blaming someone has the blameworthiness of the person blamed as its correctness condition. Because this would just become an instance of the quite general claim that beliefs have the truth of the object of belief as its truth condition. Because after all, blameworthiness is just failing to do the thing that you had reason to do when it was your fault. So if what you believe when you blame someone is that that condition is obtained, you can see why the blameworthiness of the person would be what's required for the blaming to be appropriate. Now, the trouble is, the initial suggestion is just wrong. It is not true that to blame someone is to believe that they did the wrong thing and it's their fault. And that's because we can believe that someone did the wrong thing when it's their fault without blaming them, and we can blame someone without believing that they did the wrong thing and it's their fault. So let's first of all focus on the first case, believing that someone did the wrong thing when it's their fault without blaming them. So here's my go-to example. Imagine two young boys, it would have to be boys for the example to work, two young boys at school who meet after school and they hatch a plan to go shoplifting. Now they hatch the plan to go shoplifting because they think it'll be tremendously exciting. And it'll be exciting precisely because it's wrong. So what they're planning to do is something wrong because it'll be so exciting. Now they're completely otherwise normal. Now here's what I claim about this case. I claim in this case that each of them believes that the other and they themselves is doing something wrong and that it's their fault. That is, they believe that they had the capacity to do the thing that was right, that is, not to shoplift. So the belief condition is met, but they're not blaming each other. They're egging each other on in order to keep on doing it. In fact, you can imagine a pattern developing where they go shoplifting every night and they, you know, discuss how wonderfully exciting it was and so on and so forth. I mean, I guess as you imagine this sort of developing, you could imagine that they develop an addiction to shoplifting, but don't go that far. Just imagine it. The first few times they go out shoplifting together, they each believe that they're doing the wrong thing and that it's their fault, but they're not blaming each other. They're positively egging each other on. Okay. Second case, we can blame someone without believing they did the wrong thing and it's their fault. So here's an example which seems to me proves the point. Think of any of these moral luck cases. Imagine someone who is driving a truck down a road, and they drive the truck down the road. They're perfectly attentive to the circumstance. Without being able to predict it or foresee it, and without them having done anything wrong whatsoever, a child runs in front of the truck at the last minute, and they mow the child down and kill the child. Now, here's my claim about a case like that. In such a case, someone could know perfectly well that they were not at fault. Know perfectly well that they were not at fault. And yet, they may blame themselves nonetheless. That is, they wouldn't be helped. And now, if you ask me what it means to say they blame themselves, here's what I mean by that. The thought, I did something wrong and it was my fault, constantly goes through their head as they lacerate themselves for what happened. Right? That seems to me to be a kind of completely standard case in which someone would be blaming themselves without believing that they did anything and it was their fault. Sorry, did anything wrong that was their fault. Okay, now these two cases, I think, tell you something that you should have known straight away from the nature of blame anyway, and that is that blaming someone is one of a number of psychological states that we've met in the course of these lectures that have correctness conditions, but where the psychological state that has the correctness conditions isn't belief. Now, we've had lots of examples. We've had desires like that, intentions like that, admirations like that, fears like that, trust is like that. In all these cases, you can be in the psychological state of, say, desiring something, where the correctness condition of desiring something is the desirability of the object of desire, but you can desire it not just without believing that it's desirable, but while positively believing it's undesirable. You can intend something, and you can not just not believe that it's not choice-worthy, you can positively believe that it's, contra-choice-worthy. You can admire something and without believing that it's admirable. You can fear something without believing that it's dangerous. You can trust someone without believing that they are trustworthy. These cases, I think, maybe Hannah will talk about these, but these seem to me to be the go-to cases of sociopathy. I mean, that is the experience. That was my experience in relating to having a personal relationship with a sociopath. I trusted them, but knew they weren't trustworthy. So your belief turns out, and this is a kind of interesting take-home message of a lot of these lectures, belief is a kind of, it's actually the only psychological state that has a correctness condition where believing the correctness condition obtains is what it is to be in that state. So belief is our kind of go-to, it's our standard example of a psychological state with a correctness condition, but it's actually completely atypical of psychological states with correctness conditions. These states are the typical cases, because look how many there are of them. And blame is another one. So the fact that blame is this kind of psychological state that has a correctness condition, but the psychological state is not a state of belief. And that means that you can be in the psychological state while believing the correctness condition doesn't obtain. Now this sort of makes you go back, okay, well, in that case, what is it to blame someone? Well, what about this then? When we blame someone, we think of them. Just go back to what I said about the driver of the truck. The person who's blaming themselves in that case can't help thinking that they did the wrong thing and that it was their fault. So you might think, perhaps blame is a matter of having a certain disposition to think things about yourself. Being disposed to to blame someone is to be disposed to have certain thoughts about them. It's to be disposed to think that they've done the wrong thing when it's their fault. That is, it's to be disposed to think of them as having done the wrong thing when the explanation of their doing that thing is their failure to exercise some capacity that they had, where that gets spelled out in these modal terms. Now, this, I think, is a promising idea, but I don't think this is not yet going to be answering our question. And the reason it's not going to be the answer to our question is because whereas it was completely transparent why blame would have blameworthiness as its correctness condition, if blame was a matter of believing someone to be blameworthy, it's completely opaque why blame would have blameworthiness as a condition, as its correctness condition, if what it is to blame someone is merely to think that they're blameworthy. Now, why is that so? Well, that's because thinking is a kind of ubiquitous psychological phenomenon that's involved in all sorts of activities. It's involved, for example, in fantasizing. It's involved in imagining. Now imagine, just imagine if, sorry, that's, I'm using imagine twice there, just imagine what it would be like if the only things you could fantasize about correctly were things which were true. That would severely limit the possibilities of fantasy. Fantasy seems to, I don't know what the correctness condition of fantasy is actually, but I'm pretty sure that you're allowed to go wildly off cue from things that are true. So you're not going to get the fact that blame has the blameworthiness of the person blamed as its correctness condition straight from the fact that to blame someone is to think of them as having done the wrong thing when it's their fault. Something else is going to have to be required to blame someone, and surprisingly, that other thing is going to be the thing that explains why blame has blameworthiness as its correctness condition. So the question is, what's this further thing? So it's something in addition to a disposition to have certain thoughts. So here's now my suggestion. This is my positive proposal. In a typical case, blaming someone is just a reaction to what I'm going to call the modal fragility of their acting wrongly. The modal fragility of someone's acting wrongly, by the way, is just a description of this similarity relation in the possible worlds. It's the fact that when you blame someone, the world in which they're doing the right thing is sort of just there. It's just right there and available to them. And what you're doing is you're reacting to the fact that it's right there and available to them. What is the nature of this reaction to the modal fragility of their acting wrongly? Well, the modal fragility of their acting wrongly makes salient the possibility of a future in which they don't act wrongly. After all, it was just there this time. Maybe next time they'll do the right thing. But it also alerts you to the possibility that, for all you know, this is the beginning of a pattern, and they're going to consistently act wrongly. So you're left in this kind of, I don't know, you know, hopeful yet cautious state. So the question then is, what kind of reaction do we have to someone when we react to the modal fragility of their acting wrongly that has this kind of cautious yet hopeful character? And the answer is, it has to do with trust. Where we trust someone when we're disposed to treat them as though they will do what they have reason to do when we interact with them. So, let's go back now to the case. Here's someone. You're disposed to act towards them as though they will do what they have reason to do when you interact with them. And that's not called into question by the mere fact that on this occasion, they failed to do the right thing, the thing that they had reason to do, because there it was, the world in which they're doing the right thing is just there, available to them. Maybe the next time that they act, they'll do the right thing. But trust has been called into question. And the question is, how exactly do you call it into question? So here's my suggestion. To blame someone is to think of them as having, it's to have this pattern of thoughts, it's to think of them as having done wrong when it's their fault. And it's also to add thoughts about their faulty wrongdoing to the stock of thoughts that we have about them, with a view to downgrading how much we trust them, and perhaps even giving up on trusting them altogether if a pattern of faulty wrongdoing emerges. That's what it is to blame someone. So given the modal fragility of their acting wrongly, even if a pattern of faulty wrongdoing does emerge, to blame someone is to remain open to the possibility that they will become trustworthy again. And so trust can be fully restored. So blame, in my view, co-travels with the possibility of reconciliation. So here's the kind of full-dress suggestion. Blaming someone is a state that disposes the blamer to desire to act in certain ways towards the person they blame on account of their pattern of faulty wrongdoing. Now, from previous lectures, we've already seen that if you're going to be revising your behaviour, that's a disposition to acquire desires to act accordingly. And those desires are going to be correct only if it's desirable to act in those ways towards the person blamed on account of their pattern of faulty wrongdoing. And, of course, that means that they could be correct only if the person blamed really did engage in that pattern of faulty wrongdoing. So now we know why blameworthiness has the blameworthiness of the person blamed as its correctness condition. It's because blame isn't, it's not actually because blame is a matter of being disposed to think of that person as having acted wrongly when it was their fault. It's because blame is also a disposition to act in ways on account of that. And those desires could only be correct if the person really did engage in that pattern of faulty wrongdoing. And that's for them to be blameworthy. So surprise, surprise, blame has blameworthiness as its correctness condition because of the disposition to desire things that's internal to what blame is. Okay, that's my proposal. So that's the explanation of why blame has blameworthiness as its correctness condition. So, just to kind of, I'm really just saying this again because this is sort of, you know, if you say it three times, it might go in. Blaming someone is maximally appropriate when we don't just think that they've done the wrong thing and that it's their fault, but when we know this to be so, when we accurately keep track of their faulty wrongdoing, when our disposition to downgrade our trust in them or to stop trusting them altogether is reasonable in the light of their pattern of faulty wrongdoing, and when our disposition to restore our trust in them is suitably sensitive to their future pattern of faulty wrongdoing. These are the conditions under which it's correct to blame someone. What's happening here is you're basically trading on the correctness condition of the desire that you are disposed to acquire when you blame someone, and you're backfilling all of the things that would have to be true in order for that desire's correctness condition to obtain, in order for it to be desirable to downgrade your trust in them on account of their faulty wrongdoing. Right? That's what you're doing. Okay, so that's my proposal. Now, here's the question. Why is blaming someone permissible sometimes, and why is the modal condition so important to blame? Well, blaming someone is sometimes permissible, and indeed it's sometimes obligatory, because remember what we have reasons to do. It's to help and not interfere. And sometimes those reasons just count decisively in favour of keeping track of people's trustworthiness. Right? That's how you make sure that you are helping and not interfering. Right? And the modal condition is important because the modal condition is the circumstance that makes downgrading and restoring trust in people reasonable. If the modal condition weren't satisfied, there'd be no expectation possible that the person could become trustworthy if they weren't trustworthy, or that they could, the possibility of their becoming trustworthy again. Okay. So that's the answer. Now, unfortunately, every part of this view is rejected by most people who talk about blame. So the question is, what's wrong with these alternative views, and why should you believe this view instead? Well, let's just go through them. And I'm going to try and do this. Let's see how much time we've got left. I'm going to try and do these reasonably quickly. So the best known theory of blame is a theory that would draw on Strawsonian resources. So Strawson's view seems to be that we blame someone when we have certain negative reactive attitudes towards someone. And the negative reactive attitudes in question are guilt, resentment, and indignation, and they form an interrelated trio. Now, actually, I should say Jay Wallace is in the audience today, and I think of him as the major defender of, or, you know, resuscitator of this view in modern times and defender of it. So I'm sticking my neck into the lion's jaws at this point. Now, I think that the question is, like, look, stare at that first paragraph. Is the view that I've described consistent with that, or is it opposed to that? That turns entirely on what you say the negative reactive attitudes are. So one way you could spell out the negative reactive attitudes would just be to tell the story of blame as I told it. That is, the story of trust, dispositions to trust. That would be one way. And then actually the story I've told would just turn into Strawson's story. It'd just be a version of it, a more precise version of it. But that's not, I think, the way in which this story is standardly told. And I'm just going to tell you a kind of cartoon version of the story in order to bring out how the view that I'm offering differs from what I think of as the standard way of developing the Strawsonian story. So the standard way of developing the Strawsonian story, at least as I understand it, is to focus on the negative aspect of the negative reactive attitude part, and to think of that as something like a desire that the person who did wrong suffers. So it's tied to a kind of retributive view in punishment. So on this view, to feel guilty, say, would be to suffer, and it would be to desire that one's suffering continues for some period, namely that period required for, you know, to have deserved or warranted or fitting suffering, given the wrong that one did, because one had no justification or excuse for doing that wrong. That's sort of what guilt is. And then resentment is the second person counterpart of that. To feel resentment is to desire that someone suffer some period, and to think that their suffering for that period is deserved or warranted or fitting in the light of the fact that they did something wrong to one because they had no justification or excuse for doing for the wrong that they did. And to feel indignation is the third person counterpart of that. Okay. So now, what should you think about this way of developing the Strawsonian view? And the answer is, that version of the Strawsonian view analyses blame in terms of a false normative view, because suffering is never warranted or deserved. There's never a reason to make people suffer, ever. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you can never cause people to suffer. Of course you can. But that could never be in itself a justification for doing it, whereas on this view, it is. Because suffering is the warranted response to having done wrong. On the view I described, that isn't true at all. The only reasons you have are to help and not interfere. Suffering would always be something which is, on the face of it, wrong, because it would be a way of interfering with people. That's my take, actually, on the Strawsonian views. The Strawsonian views basically build in false presuppositions into the normative structure of blame. Surprisingly, what I think this means is you should be an error theorist about blame if you think with me that it's never warranted to cause suffering in people. Because blame, the ordinary attitude that Strawson is perhaps accurately describing, would build in thoughts about the warranted nature of suffering in response to faulty wrongdoing. And as I say here, it's just not going to help if you back off from thinking of it as a psychological state of suffering and think of it there being a moral principle that tells you to impose a sanction. Because so long as those sanctions turn out to be harms, there'll always be a reason to not cause harm. And that is that it'll always be a way of interfering with someone. So, that's the problem. So this is the view that I've offered is better because it doesn't build in false normative presuppositions into the account of blame. The normative presupposition that I've made is just completely uncontroversial, and that is that it's just not reasonable to continue to trust someone and make yourself vulnerable to them if they're going to constantly let you down. That's just common sense. That's what I said at the beginning it was going to be. So the normative presuppositions are just completely platitudinous, I think. So here's another view. This is a kind of version of the quality of will view defended by Nomi Arpaly. Nomi thinks that Huck Finn is praiseworthy for allowing Jim to escape because his action has positive moral worth, and where it's having positive moral worth is a matter of Huck's being motivated by recognition of Jim's moral status, which is the very fact about Jim that makes it right to help him escape slavery. In other words, what you're responding to when you praise Jim is the quality of his will. His will is oriented to the very features of his action that make it right for him to help Jim escape. Of course, he doesn't believe that, but that doesn't matter. You're responding to the quality of his will. So if you then kind of think of what the counterpart view for that would be for blame, blameworthy agents would fail to be motivated by the moral reasons that justify their actions, whether out of indifference to the moral good or a desire for something morally bad. So on that view, blame turns out, too, to be a reaction to the quality of will that people express in their actions. Now, is the view that I've given a version of the quality of will view, or is it opposed to the quality of will view? Again, I feel a little bit equivocal on this. Sometimes I feel like if you told the story in a certain way, maybe the story I've told is a version of the quality of will view, because you are indeed responding to something about the structure of their psychology. If that's what a will is, then you're responding to their quality of will. You're certainly not, though, responding to the sorts of things that Arpaly was talking about, And that's because, according to the view that I've proposed, what you blame people for is doing the wrong thing when it's their fault. That's what you blame them for. You're not blaming them for their quality of will. Right? You're not blaming them for their quality of will. You're blaming them for doing the wrong thing when it's their fault. And that's just different from blaming them for the quality of will because, and this is the crucial point, and I'll give you some examples to make this seem plausible, because someone can do the wrong thing when it's their fault, even when their will, that is what they care about intrinsically, is perfectly aligned with their moral reasons, and even when that fact about them gets expressed in their actions. So, just come down here, look at this. Just imagine someone who knows that their moral reasons to help and not interfere count in favour of their acting in a certain way, and they have corresponding intrinsic concerns, and yet they fail to act on these reasons because they have but failed to exercise their capacity to be globally instrumentally rational. Right? Now imagine further that they regret what they do as soon as they do it. So their intrinsic concerns are expressed in their actions because of the regret that they had. If blaming that person can still be appropriate, which it seems to me it can, then it can't be that what we're blaming them for is the quality of will that they express in their actions. Rather, what we must be blaming them for is the fact that, as in this case, they did the wrong thing when it was their fault. Now, I think that this sort of tells you something about the quality of will view, and that is that it's basically tied praiseworthiness much too closely to virtue and purity of heart, as I say, and it ties blameworthiness far too closely to viciousness or hard-heartedness. And the thing that we've basically been picking up on is that there's something in between virtue and viciousness, something in between purity of heart and hard-heartedness, which is the psychology of someone who has self-control and exercises. Now, why is that different? It's going to be different because what you're going to be doing is you're going to be blaming people for their failure to exercise self-control when they had it available to them. And their ability to do that just looks like it's going to have nothing to do with whether or not they're pure of heart or hard-hearted. So, let's just go here. So just to see the difference, just consider people who succeed in acting permissibly by being motivated by some mixture of considerations. We actually talked about these cases last week. These cases in which, say, you're actually pretty selfish, but you know what the right thing to do is, and you have organised the institutional and social pressures that surround you in ways that make sure that, given your rather selfish nature, you will always end up doing the right thing. Now, such a person, when they act permissibly, what they're doing is they're expressing a certain fact about their psychology, namely their capacity for self-control. And what you're praising them for is that. You're praising them for that. By contrast, what you would be blaming them for if they failed to do what they had reason to do would not be the fact that they're acting selfishly, but the fact that they acted impermissibly. Why isn't it the fact that they're acting selfishly that you're blaming them for? Because they would have been acting selfishly even if they'd acted permissibly. That wasn't the thing that was distinguishing the person who you blame and the one that you don't. In each case, they're acting selfishly. What you did was you blamed them for their failure to exercise self-control. And the view of blame that I've described actually is tailor-made to make cases like that come out with the correct answer. Because on that view, what you blame people for, what you're doing is you're keeping track, remember, of their trustworthiness. How exactly they manage to do what they have reason to do, that's a black box. That's not anything that is of any concern to you insofar as you're keeping track of their trustworthiness. You're just concerned in the reliability of the way in which they do it. If they do it via self-control, great. So I And I just want to emphasise this because, again, this came up last time in the discussion. So on the view that I've described here, really the core concept for understanding blame and being successful in avoiding blame is the concept of self-control. But it's going to be a completely empirical question, how you best exploit techniques of self-control. So let me just describe three ways in which you might do that. One way in which you might exercise self-control is by imagining your ideal counterpart and trying really hard to acquire desires just like those your ideal counterpart has. That would be trying really hard to be perfect and pure of heart, right? A second possibility might be you've got reasonably shabby motives, but you know that you can, for example, exploit other people's opinion of you by and thereby get yourself to do the right thing. So here's an example to prove that point. You're at a party, you have pretty shabby motives, you can't resist getting a laugh, even when it's at the expense of a friend. On the other hand, you know that you should not tell jokes at the expense of a friend. All of a sudden, people start telling stories about a friend of yours because you know them so well, you, and they're pretty silly, you are the source of many such stories. You could tell the most delicious such stories, but they would be really cruel. Now, in this circumstance, your selfish desires, the desires to be hilarious in the centre of the room and so forth, they're all going to tell in favour of you telling these stories, but you can exercise self-control in order to not do that by blurting out, "He's a friend of mine, actually," thereby causing the room to sort of temperature come down and people don't no longer exploit the same pressure on you to tell the story. Now, why does that work? Well, it works like that, like this. Even if they continue to tell these hilarious stories about your friend, you now know that they will think you're a total asshole if you tell a story. Because after all, that would be you, his really great friend, telling this story and making him look like a fool. Right. So you can exploit your techniques of self-control like that. Alternatively, and this is the thing that you pointed out, Paul, last week, you could wholly externalise the techniques of self-control. You could bring it about that the environment in which you work sets up incentive structures to make sure that only behaviour that there's reason to perform is the behaviour that you'll engage in. And you never, ever have to exert self-control because your selfish motivations are always incentivised towards doing the right thing. On the view that I've described here, it's wholly empirical which of these you should be using in any particular context. It really does. It's not a matter to be decided at the level of the abstract a priori. Right. The question is, I'll just repeat, the question is, which of them would get you to reliably do what you have reason to do? Which of them would best do that? And then the rational response will be to go for the one that does that. Okay, so the last view that I want to talk about, and this is where I'll stop, and this is good because we're just about out of time. The last view I want to talk about is Tim Scanlon's view that blame is always relative to a relationship. So here's what Scanlon thinks. He thinks that to judge someone blameworthy is to think that they have done something, this is up here, that indicates intentions or attitudes that are faulty by the standards of a relationship that we have with them. Now, that sounds a little bit to me like the quality of will view. That sounds like you have a relationship with someone and what you're expecting of them is that they have the intentions and desires constitutive of the ideal of that relationship. In the moral case, that would be desires to do the things that are morally correct. In the case of friendship and so on, that would be different. But again, they'd be these ideal attitudes. To blame people, in Scanlon's view, is to judge them to be blameworthy, and as a consequence, to alter, this is the crucial bit, to alter or withhold intentions and expectations that our relationships with them would normally involve in particular ways that the judgment of blameworthiness makes appropriate. So in other words, the idea is that to blame someone is to change your relationship with them in virtue of recognising that they have intentions that are faulty by the standards of the relationship. Now, actually, I'm just going to skip through here and go straight to this last point. I think that there's... I got this from the horse's mouth. Tim Scanlon thinks that the view I've described is the view, is his view. And if that's true, then that's great. If that's all that he meant by having a relationship, and if that's all he meant by changing your relationship, what I've said, then terrific. I don't, however, think if that... I do think that if that's what he means, then his the way he's put it is pretty misleading. And it's pretty misleading because, and this is the last thing that I want to end on, because there are many cases in which blaming someone is part and parcel of what makes the relationships that they are. And I think of this as the completely... I think of that as a complete platitude, actually, about marriage. And my proof of this is going to reside in the 1970s dramedy, 30-something, which many of you will not know what it is. But this is just a little clip from 30-something. And this is, just to let you know, that there are three characters here. Turn the lights off. There are three characters here. The one in the middle is a friend of the one on the left and the one who... Okay, just check out the woman on the left, okay, the one with the dark hair. She's married to the bloke who comes up in the film clip, and this is a friend who's just dropped off some baby clothes for them to use because she has older children, and this woman and the man have a younger child, so she's sort of, you know, giving them their baby clothes. The couple are about to go off on an interesting romantic camping trip. Just listen. Now, the question, what I want you to do here is keep track of the number of blaming incidents that happen in this. Okay, so here's my claim about that film clip. I counted, and I can do it for you if you want, but I count roughly 5 moments in that film clip where what happens is one or the other of Michael and Hope are the couple, by the way. One or the other of Michael and Hope basically call the other one on their behaviour. That is, they draw to their attention that they believe that they are the other one, that is trying to pull the wool over their eyes in some way. And they call them on it, and it's done in this playful way, but it's the very thing that makes their relationship possible and strong. So that's a kind of blaming behaviour. It is a adding stock of thoughts about faulty wrongdoing to your stock of faulty thoughts. And it is done with a view to downgrading your trust, if such a thing continues. But, of course, you never downgrade your trust. You never change your relationship with them, because the very fact that you've got this playful technique for keeping each other in check is the very thing that makes the relationship strong and trusting in the way that it is. Now, like I said, that seems to me to be a... I think that's... It's almost the status of a platitude that that's how these sorts of human adult relationships work. And the fact that they work in that way seems to me to tell decisively against Scanlon's suggestion that when you blame someone, you change your relationship with them. It can't be true that when you blame someone, you change your relationship with them, if the way in which you maintain your relationship with people is by engaging in these blaming behaviours. Okay, so that's why you should believe this view rather than Scanlon's. So just to sum up, what I'd said I was going to do is I was going to tell you what blame is. Blame turns out to be this complex disposition. Think that someone has done wrong, to keep track of those thoughts with a view to changing your trusting relationship with them if necessary. That is, to end up desiring to do things on account of their fault and wrongdoing. That explains why blame has blameworthiness of the person involved, of the person you're blaming is its correctness condition, because those desires would only have desirable objects if the person you're blaming had done engaged in fault and wrongdoing. And that story of what blame is tells you that it's sometimes permissible, indeed obligatory, to blame, because these blaming behaviours are the sorts of things that make it possible for us to help and not interfere with each other. Okay, that's the end. Thank you.